I remember the name, Killian.
Good evening, everyone. It's great to see you. You're watching the Car Sim and Race Driver Show with me, Hugh Hattrick, and my very special commentator and co-host, Andrew Marr.
Hello.
It's good to see you, Andrew. We've had lots of laughs in the build-up to the show, which is probably just as well it can't go out. But but it tells us on the show. Exactly. It tells us that it's showtime. So we can't keep people waiting. So we were thinking of the music of famous movies that mentioned that phrase. And the one that came to mind was The Running Man with Schwarzenegger when he comes back for Killian.
I hope they try and remake that film. They made such a mess of Total Recall.
Total Recall. Yeah.
There were two like one of the brilliant things in Total Recall, Kate Beckinsale and Jessica Biel. But I mean, they could have just been standing there, frankly, because it would have been about the same as the rest. It would have been better because there would have been less awfulness, just them standing there being alive.
It's funny because that film is just so good. The original is amazing. And yet they screwed it up in every possible way. It was too busy. It wasn't funny. It wasn't, it just didn't have much to it. But anyway, this is a car show, of course. And we have been...
They had nice flying cars. I liked their flying cars.
Yes. Did you the taxis in the original were hilarious. They were with a little joystick, remember, in the robot.
The Johnny Cab.
Yeah, Johnny Cab. It's Johnny Cab.
The special effects were so bad.
It was really
just so awful.
But it kind of made it in the movie, though, didn't it?
Oh, my goodness.
That little baby creep.
That was seriously creepy.
But but it was because he had, I can never remember his name, but the guy that played, not the ultimate bad guy, not, was it Cohagen?
But the other one, his kind of main assassin.
He's such a good actor. He was in so many of the films.
He was in all the Eddie Murphy ones, wasn't it? The kind of the cop ones, Beverly Hills Cop. He was the baddie in that, was he not?
No.
Was he not in the baddie in that with somebody else?
Right. Okay. The main big bad guy was the captain of the precinct down in Beverly Hills. And also he was the bad guy. He was the OCP boss in the original. Proper version of, I've forgotten what it's called.
Is that Robocop?
Robocop, thank you. He had Running Man in my head and I had an R. Robocop. He was the bad guy there. But good actor. But no, he was, that was him. No, I'm thinking of the Bolding guy. He was in another, by the same director as Robocop. Starship Troopers. He was the teacher and lieutenant guy that got killed and eaten, half eaten.
Well, there's a very famous film, and it's a car film. And normally car films are terrible, but there was one that was done in the 70s, early 70s, called it's gone straight into my head. It's the one where they race through Paris, in a Ferrari. And it was by a director called Mr. Lacluche. And it was similarly Jack Lafitte.
It was just a camera in the Ferrari going through Ferrari, right?
Yep. In fact, I will go back because I've got it back on here. I can't believe I had it.
I know the film you mean, and it keeps coming up in these lists of brilliant car chase driving footage. Yeah.
Rendezvous. How could I have
forgotten that one? Okay.
So it was in the Le Rendezvous when he races through Paris. And he had asked in the 70s to have the streets of Paris closed off so he could do this, you see. Mm. And, of course, the authorities had said no way. No. So he did it anyway. Being French, he just ignored it. And he did it early in the morning on a Sunday. And it's famous because he's doing 145 miles an hour in this. It's actually in a Mercedes, but with a Ferrari 275 soundtrack dubbed on it.
BMW, isn't it? You can buy a BMW diesel and they're playing inside and outside. They do it on both. And speakers outside as well. Some V8 sound.
Yeah. Well, guess who is remaking, who's going to be the driver remaking the Rendezvous?
Let me just have a little guess. Charles Leclerc.
Ah, you've seen it.
I saw the headline, right? I saw the headline. The headline is... Charles Leclerc set up to remake controversial motorsport film. What you just said is just click. I didn't read it. It was a guess. It was just an hegemonicated guess.
It was very, very good guess, and they're doing it in Monaco.
Glasses on, you see. These are my Eric Morgan glasses.
Well, they're doing it in Monaco this Sunday because it would have been the Monaco Grand Prix, and the streets of Monaco are closed between like 6:30 in the morning and 9:00. And he's going to do all of that. They're going to race through Monaco. I don't know what car it is. I don't know how they're going to all do it, but that is the plan. So it's going to be, when that comes out, that could be quite fun.
That'll be excellent.
It'll look good.
Let's do a pop quiz. Is that the term? I never did a pop quiz. The pop quiz to me is that thing that happened on Friday nights on Radio 1. That was the pop quiz. No, the pop quiz is on Radio 2 with your fellow Scott, isn't it? It's about 11 o'clock.
All right. To be fair, I don't listen to Radio 1, Radio 2, to be honest.
It's really famous. But, DJ. One of the last of the DJs before they go on to the idiots that are currently on Radio 1.
What was your pop quiz all about then?
It was, okay, there's a connection here then. Then I'm trying not to give you too many clues. What famous film with an incredibly famous car chase in it had exactly the same problem where they asked permission to do a car chase through an American city? Didn't get it, so they just put a camera, a director, and a driver, and they smashed through, I think it's New York. It's one where they've got the rail cars going above. And there's this...
It was in the 70s, wasn't it?
They are just canning it through the city.
That was one of the detective ones. It was like a murder film, wasn't it? With that chap. He's retired now.
Here we go now. I'm going to give you my first clue is... This is a clue to the name of the character. He's strong to the finish because he eats its spinach.
Popeye the Sailor Man.
Ah, but not Popeye the Sailor Man. The name of the character is Popeye Doyle, played by a very famous actor you're trying to recall. Very good.
Because he goes, they're chasing under the New York bridges, isn't it? Like the metro. He's shouting at everybody, telling them to get out of the way.
Pram walks in front of them.
Aye. Oh, he was in that film with Will Ferrell. Will Smith, the enemy of the state.
He was also in Superman.
Yes, he was the baddie, wasn't he? He was the...
And he was also
It's gone straight from my head.
Quick in the Dead?
Am I going to have to cheat here and look on Google? But
look on Google. But there is...
Oh, Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman.
Yes.
But the name of the film, sir, what is it? Now, if you think about what you said earlier about how they're going through Paris, there's a connection with Paris in the name of the film.
What's the connection
with the city in that country? It would be...
The French Connection.
French Connection.
You see, I'm getting there.
I didn't say it right at the beginning. It's got a French connection. That's a super. There's three films that always come top three in all, these top 50 chase movies kind of thing. One of them is French Connection. The top one is always Bullet because, Steve McQueen, San Francisco. And they interviewed people like the director, and he was in the car with the camera. Oh. That's how they did it, with Steve McQueen driving. No stunt driver, Steve McQueen, because he was a hell of a driver. Yeah. Gets to the end of the chase, and he says, "We've got a problem." What's the problem? Because we've got no brakes. He burnt the brakes.
Goodness me.
And he's like, "Okay, so how do we stop?" He goes, "I'll figure something out." So, but the third one also has a connection with... The Fifth Element.
With Bruce Willis. And
hold on, I'm saying that. I don't know when I was...
I thought Ronan. Ronan always does well. Because there's some great car chases with Ronan.
Genius. One of my favourite films of all time. Yeah. Is that not directed by Luc Besson?
Yes. Yeah.
And have you noticed in all these other films like Lucy and all this kind of stuff, he always has a very similar car chase in it. They don't quite do it as well as they did it in Ronin, but Ronin, what a
Lenin's classic. Absolutely amazing film. Really, really good.
First film I've seen where, you know, when you get that high speed float, you know, when a car goes and it floats. When they speed the film up, you can tell you don't get it because the float's too quick. When that Audi S8 is going through the streets of Marseille and the car's floating on the suspension when it goes over bump, that's the first film I've seen that happen because they're really going incredibly fast in this car. I love that film.
And the Bourne Identity was good. You know, the first one with Matt Damon, when he has the Mini and he takes it around. It's also Marseille, I think, I must say. That was quite good. I quite enjoyed that, actually, because he goes down steps and everything in it.
One of those, they have some big car chase with a big Merc G-Wagon 4x4 thing.
This one's just with the police. He's just taken off from the police.
I've just got an image of a big black Mercedes.
May have done maybe one of the other ones.
AMG G63.
Yeah. That one was really good. So that was really good. That now, if you're watching us on Facebook, we don't always see your comments. Although, to be fair, the comment I put on earlier on when we were advertising the post did actually come up. But if you are watching on Facebook and you want to comment, then just click the link that I've put in the descriptions there, and it will come up, and you'll be able to go onto YouTube, and then you can see us live and comment as much as you like. Tell us, what do you think are your favourite car films, as we're on that topic at the moment? What's your favourite car chase? Because, to be fair, in most modern films now, there has to be a car chase at some point.
No, but it's so generic now, it's awful. I mean, silly car chase. If somebody is making a film, and you know that I'm quite opinionated on these things, which is obviously completely out of character for me. Shut up, you. If someone decides, right, we're just going to not take this seriously and it's going to be stupid. So like in Men in Black, where they have a car chase and the car can fly, or that fantastic Ford Prefect or whatever it is.
That was quite good.
We're just going to be nuts. Forget about it.
Yeah. You can get away with it if it's science fiction to some
degree. Yeah, fair enough. Or if they're just going to do silly things, fair enough. So like in the remake of Gone in 60 Seconds with Nick Cage and all them lots.
Yeah, that was quite fun. That was quite...
I mean, that car chase with Eleanor at the end.
Yeah.
There's no way that car would have survived in one in any way. It's just like... And this idea that you press the button and all of a sudden it goes 160 miles an hour and that will cut out.
But they modified it. Did they not modify the car?
Yeah, it'd been... Yeah, but still, the idea that it can out drag or get away from a helicopter. It was fun, and it was meant to be fun. Plus, you had that fantastic V8 sound.
And like the Tom Cruise, I have to say, the Mission Impossible, the Rogue Nation, the last one that they did, the car chase scenes in that are really good. The BMW M series cars,
they are quite good. In the earlier ones, I hate them.
They were a bit too special effects, but now he does them all.
Triumph Daytona, which is one of my favorite bikes. I've gone on about that bike. And every time, I hate it when they do this. You've got a bike. Now, there's a big, there can be many opinions about which is faster, a car or a bike. And in many ways, a car can be much faster because it's got the four tires and this kind of stuff. But one thing a bike does really well is accelerate. So they've got this 10-ton 4x4. Every time they cut, it's right behind them again, or it goes around the corner, and the bike would be a mile away.
That is the thing.
I don't care what engine is in it; there's not a chance in hell it would keep up with a motorbike.
Yeah.
Plus, every time it cuts, when it's on a bit of tarmac, the suspension's normal, and then every time it goes up a bit of grass, the suspension's got 2 feet. It's like wow, magic suspension. Press the button, boing. No. This is why I love Ronin and Bullet and French Connection, all this kind of stuff, because it's just fantastically fast driving in a ridiculous way.
Now, one of the topics we were going to talk about today as well, I thought, was because I've had a little bit of feedback from our commentary on Sunday night. Because obviously we were trying to commentate on the Heineken challenges that were a bit of a joke. So that's why I did that podcast earlier on in the week about that as well. And I'll put the link in the description a bit later on when this goes out afterwards. But it was a bit of a joke, really, wasn't it, on Sunday night? And I just thought people aren't going to be interested in us kind of say, oh, the race has started, and one lap later it's finished, and then there's another 15 minutes worth of studio time before the next one starts.
Three laps. You get one lap in, and frankly, that one lap was quite exciting because it was like a demolition derby, wasn't it? The first corner. I mean, they went round the centre S, and that other driver we hadn't really heard of before just steamboned Rosberg. Was fantastic.
Was it Dornbos, wasn't it? It was Dornbos. I think it was him who kept.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it was, that was super.
It was hilarious.
Because of just the fact that he just went completely T-boned the guy.
Coulthard did his fair share of ramming. It
goes back to 15 minutes of the tennis commentator and that idiot with the glasses. And like you said, in your little majiggy, oh, hello, Ant. Ant's
appeared. Hello, Ant.
Just like that idiot. The Twitch comments were going up, going, we can talk, real sarcastic comments. We get it.
And it makes me wonder now, that's probably why Sky haven't really touched it with their normal Sky team. Because they've seen what they're doing and thinking, we can't have anything to do with that. We don't want our name associated with that. Because, I mean, the chat was terrible. Yeah, I mean, the chat was, I would say 80%, if not higher, against what was happening. There were a few in there saying, oh, come on, they're just trying to do the job. But the vast majority of it was saying, this is a joke, this is awful. It is because we expect more. This is Formula One here. And they need to get their act together. We need to get all the drivers on playing the game, getting it sorted out, doing some kind of race. And it's got to go out live, and it needs to have Brundle and Croft doing the commentary, ideally, so we can get that covered, or Brundle. It's got to be able to do that.
DC, their last season before Sky took over.
Yeah, it took over, and it was the last. That was their best season, I think. That was the,
because they got the two best. They got the two best doing it, and Brundle became the lead anchor, didn't he? And then DC was going to be the technical guy. Well, frankly, you just got two people to listen to. So, yeah.
They were both really good. Now, was that 2012? Was that the last one?
No.
I think, because that was the year. Here's a bit of trivia for you. I think, was it in the first seven races, there were seven different winners?
Yes.
It was an incredible season.
That was
incredible.
An awesome year.
Yeah. Because Hamilton,
they had five world champions in the field.
Yes. Hamilton, Schumacher, Alonso, Vettel, and Button.
Wasn't Villeneuve in there as well?
No, I don't think he was in there at that time. Not in 2012. I think he'd retired by then. He retired in mid-2000s. But yeah, no, it would have been because it was Vettel, Alonso, Schumacher, Button, and Hamilton. Yeah, and
Raikkonen.
Oh yeah, Raikkonen as well. So maybe even more.
Nick Schumacher came back in 2013, didn't he?
He came in 2010 to 2012, and then he finished his career in 2012.
Okay.
And I think so, because then that's where Hamilton took his seat in effect in 2013.
Yes, that's Benoit Rosberg. Immensely.
Yeah, because that was the thing, because remember they were going to try and get Hamilton to come in earlier, so he could have been Schumacher's teammate just for the last few races, but they couldn't quite manage it.
No, can't release him, would they? Old 1-1 didn't
like.
Did you ever see any of the footage or the interviews with old Ron Dennis after Lewis went? Talk about a bitter man. Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
it's like
he was quite.
It's like you've got an ex-girlfriend and you just let rip. On Facebook, it wasn't professional. It was like, well, we made him, and it'll be rubbish there. He'll find it a lot harder there. You'll never find anybody as good looking as me. So yeah, that was quite sad.
I mean, it was a brave move, because I always remember thinking, "God, that's quite an interesting one." It was a kind of bit of a shock when Hamilton announced he was going to Mercedes, because they hadn't been that good at all with the V8 cars. But they reckoned that they had that head start on the hybrids, hadn't they? That was the thing. But well, he
the
did
V8
do
hybrids.
The new V6s.
They knew a couple of years before, and Ross Brawn had set Mercedes off on that path to make that incredible motor that was just dominant for so long. And this is the thing that confuses me. I mean, you know how much I love Niki Lauda, and it's the year anniversary now, isn't it, of his death?
Yeah.
There's been a lot of stuff online and in the F1 websites going on about Niki Lauda. And again, they're talking about how instrumental he was in bringing Lewis in. Now, I'm sure he was. Yeah, absolutely. But at the time, Lewis was saying he went there because of Ross Brawn. Mm-hmm. I remember very, very clearly. And it's funny because I wasn't surprised he went. I wasn't surprised at all. Because Ross Brawn was there. Oh. And, you know, we've all seen what Ross Brawn can achieve.
Yeah, Ferrari, Benetton and all of that, yeah.
Benetton, Ferrari, the Jaguar Le Mans team. He designed the, is it JR9 that totally dominated that time? And, you know,
he knew
what he was doing. And I think he, like me, could see the potential of the team because they were coming up with some incredible ideas. Do you remember I can't remember what they called it. It was the S duct. Everybody else had the F duct.
Oh, yeah.
And they had that stored the front and the rear wing, so you kept the balance.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a double duct. That sort of thing. It didn't work as well as they hoped, but it was still an amazing idea. Very like this tracking thing that they've got at the moment.
Yeah.
Like a little thing that would have given them a bit.
I was surprised.
And then, of course, it got sidelined. And
that was that.
Over. So now it's running everything.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a brave move, and it was something else. So it was good to see it. And now, I mean, look where he's gone from there. That it was quite interesting. So the question remains: what will happen for the next F1 virtual race? Because they don't give you very much time. They don't. And they only really give you a day or even less to tell you.
They tell you nothing. They don't tell you who's in it. They don't.
Yeah,
I'm amazed. Races that they've been doing as a virtual race.
Yeah.
What a brilliant thing. That, like you say, they've got their normal commentary team. They've got
it looks almost real.
Grid.
Yeah, yeah.
Of the actual Formula E season.
Yeah.
And it's a championship. They've got points involved. They have other people in it as well. They've got it's not just the grid. It's also they've got some like celebrity people in as well, haven't they? I think.
Yeah, I think probably. They've got a few footballers in there.
Time, every Saturday.
A chef and a few others.
a BBC
presenter probably in there too. And that, you've got the diversity rules, you know. Somebody from Watchdog or The One Show.
No, that's the chef, isn't it? You've got to have a chef. You know, there's normal people and then a chef.
Yeah. No.
Because we can't do Saturday morning... To make up the fact that we can't do Saturday Kitchen, we're going to have Matt Tebbutt in the network.
Exactly, doing his bit in the Formula E. But they did look really realistic, actually. And same with the IndyCar in America. The IndyCar E-Series is remarkably realistic, the way that they did it. I watched the one from Texas when Lando Norris won, and that was spectacular, but really, really good stuff. Top end, and it just shows you they've obviously had it prepared and ready, and it's and they've already had it launched and it's worked.
It speaks a lot about the attitude of the Formula One people to their fans, or it's a worrying thought to me. Obviously, the Formula E people are going, we need to treat our fans well. Let's do a good job on this. Let's do something for them. The IndyCar people the same.
Yeah. You kind of think they could have done anything because, like, the F1 2019 is a really good game and its classic setup is brilliant. So you kind of think they could have just said, right, let's do a neutral race. So they all have to drive the same car. But it could be something, like a team that's no longer there or like a car that's no longer there, like a Lotus or whatever it might be that was it. And then they could have had everyone in one of those with a different number and a different, and it would have been quite fun. But they should have got everybody to have a go and look at some, because, you know, it's not like a world championship event. What do they used to call them? If it wasn't a world championship event in Formula One, they would call it something else, wasn't it?
A non-championship race.
yeah, that would make sense. The one, it was like a cup event or something. It was, there was a special. Oh, I thought there was a special name for them. It was like a non-championship, but you know, there was like a special thing. It would be like a kind of Goodwood Cup or something, or a good, you know, like an, like when they raced the Aintree or something.
I have decided that's what it's called.
A non-championship event. Okay, a cup.
This is the
The Formula One Cup event. Yeah, Formula One Cup.
They could have put it on any circuit they like, any circuit they've got. They could call it the Interlagos Cup.
They could have had it at Zandvoort. They could have had it
The old Zandvoort. They couldn't do it on the new one because they haven't got it programmed in. They've already said that.
All right, because I mean, the new game's about to be launched quite soon.
They showed a bit of footage of a simulation of it.
Yeah. Maybe the game hadn't quite had it finished.
The game F2019, so they couldn't do it.
Because 2020 is about to be launched, I think, in the next month or two, but that would be the thing. But you think all the other circuits they could have had, you know, they could have got them all together and said, look, you're contracted to race. If you've got a contract with your team to race this year, you've got to race with us. And, you know, they've got enough money to send over a sim rig and get it sorted out so everybody has it sorted, you know.
I would have liked to see them put older tracks on, or older versions of tracks, so like the original Hockenheim.
Yes, that would have been quite great. Original Imola.
Do the proper
Imola before pre-94.
Spa before they got rid of the bus stop.
Because
they got rid of the bus stop for safety reasons, fair enough. We've both seen cars get T-boned by
huge chunks in there.
You know, it wasn't just they got hit. It's like, oh, look, there's a knife. It's like in these American car chase things where the car hits the thing and splits in half, you know. Fair enough. But it wouldn't matter in that game, would it? They could race the bus stop, which was a great overtaking opportunity at the end of a 220-mile-an-hour drive.
Yeah, because that's really what it was, wasn't it? I remember Hill. I'm sure Hill overtook Schumacher in one of those races, didn't he? Hill overtook Schumacher. Not in 97?
I remember that it was the one that hit in the rain.
Yeah.
He overtook bearing down on him and being told
he wasn't there.
And then Jordan basically said, listen, we want a win, and if you two start racing each other, we'll have a nothing. As it is, 1-2. This is in the days when we were yellow, the Hornets.
That's right. I quite like the look of that car.
I had a
And there was one for sale, by the way. One of those for sale. A Benetton, it was a Jordan Benson and Hedges Honda. I think it was a car, and it wasn't even that much, to be fair. I think they wanted like 150 grand for it, but it wasn't, when you think of what the car is, it wasn't actually that much. That was maybe about a year ago. I remember seeing it on it wasn't an auction site, it was a racing car for sale site thing that they had.
Can you imagine starting because that was the V10 era?
Yeah.
They're not your neighbours, even if they're a mile off.
You need a really decent private drive so you could just race up and down the drive in it.
It's your own estate.
You know.
I watched a video years ago on YouTube, actually, but it was a sort of a rendition of a TV show, and it was an hour and a half long with Alan Decadene. You heard of him?
All right. All right.
He's a racing driver. His daughter's thingy Decadene, blonde, toppy model kind of thing. She used to do I have no idea. I've heard of her. Amanda Decadene is some model, and that's his daughter. But he's famous in his own right. He's very posh. You can tell. But it was great because he was doing a sort of a potted history of Jaguar.
Uh-huh.
But the way he did it is he would talk about the history, and then he'd drive it on this huge estate with its own racing track. I don't know where it was, but it looked gorgeous. I think it was in Britain somewhere. It might not have been in Britain. Around this lake, there was this kind of lake and a big manor house and all this kind of stuff. Not Goodwood.
There's a few other. I'm trying to think of a few circuits. Perhaps one of our viewers might know what it might be. Aintree is the one.
That's the one that. I said Liverpool racetrack, horse racing track, was also where the British Grand Prix was because that was the first British Grand Prix won by a Brit.
It's not Oldham Park, and it's not
So Stirling.
I think there's one or two little places that they've done on fifth gear. Fifth gear have used. And it wasn't the one down your way in Wales. It was another one.
I have seen it in other programs.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't look like a track in the sense of what we're used to as a track. It looked like...
It's quite narrow. It's not quite very narrow.
Going around a humongous estate, you know, like the Pemberley estate. You expect Jane Austen to pop out and be waving at the car as it goes past with a horse.
There is a Pembrey track. There's a Pembrey track. Pembrey.
It's not that one.
It's quite small, but I think I know of one or two.
But it was long. But the thing is he's driving everything from XK120s, D types, the first early V12 ones, and talking about it all. It's absolutely superb. Really good program. Really, really nice program. And you're getting all of this. You're just getting that noise and that sound. Yeah. That was a great place you need if you had your own V10 F1.
Well, there's a great video that I watched today from Bosley92, which is I'm subscribed on YouTube, and he's well worth subscribing because he gets all his cars like from Monza track days, and he was at a special track day last year, and they had the DTM car, which was the Alpha 155 with a 2.5-litre V6 engine in it.
Oh, right.
It was the last year that they used the DTMs. I think it was from like 96 or something, or 97, I think it was. For the German touring cars. It must have been quite a successful car, I think. And they were racing it around Monza. Well, it wasn't Monza, it was somewhere else.
Was this the World Touring Car?
I thought it was German touring cars or something.
Because I know they did a 155 2.5-litre World Touring Car.
Yeah, it sounded amazing. They also had Tarquini's, that was Tarquini's car. They also had his BTCC car there as well, because the red one. And that was also going around the same track, but was nowhere near as fast as this thing.
M car here.
It's worth watching, actually. When I do the video at the very end and I redo the description, I will make sure that I put that in there because it's fantastic.
Sorry, I'm just looking at very.
It's nice. well worth watching.
It's the right colour.
Green. Compared to those videos.
Not green.
Aye. Now that's the thing. So this weekend, there's going to be obviously Leclerc doing his movie in Monaco, because it would have been the Monaco Grand Prix. I wonder whether we might get a Monaco Grand Prix virtual race, potentially. If so, we'll be doing our best to commentate on that. Hopefully, there'll be more of it than what we had on Sunday night, more than just one lap. And we'll see how we go. And I just wonder how long it's going to be before... There is a new virtual F1 commentary team in there.
Or changing every 2 minutes anyway. They started with people we'd heard of, well, a person we'd heard of, and it's gone down to no one we've heard of. And the only one they've kept consistently is that Bert with a silly glass.
Another one.
Sillier than these.
It is something. It is definitely something else. So we will certainly be covering the commentary. If there is a race on Sunday, we'll let you know. Look out for posts on the Car Sim and Race Driver Show and let us know what would be your ideal race for us to commentate on, because we're always looking for good races to have a shot, and we can watch it on YouTube, turn the sound down and give it, and we'll give it our unique sense of taste of commentary.
Basically, just if we're not on, just shout at the screen, cheaters, that's meant to be a corner, and it'll basically be what I say anyway. Alonso, Renault.
Yes.
Should we talk about that?
Yes, that is another headline with a distinct.
You subscribe to Auto Sport, don't you? And I saw a headline saying he'd signed a pre-agreement.
Yes.
Did you read it properly? Do you know what a pre-agreement is? Does anybody know? Is it like, I agree to make an agreement at some point?
I think he was looking to see what the racing was going to be like. I think it's because originally the new regulations were coming in 2021, and he thought it might be a bit closer, the cars might be a bit better, and he might have a chance at doing quite well.
He doesn't want to be in a car he can't win in.
Yeah.
The guy, I can't remember his name, one in charge of McLaren. Not the principal, not the really sensible one that's turning him around, but the the guy who's his boss. Big fat American fella. Zach thingamajig.
Yeah. Zach Brown.
Could be. He was saying if Lonzo wanted to come back here, it's a no-brainer. Because, you know, it's Alonso.
It's
pretty good. I don't know what Ricardo would think of that. This idea that Vettel will go to a midfield team, get stuff. This idea that Mercedes will have him. That's Hamilton's team now.
Whatever
else happens, that's Hamilton's team.
I'd be very surprised, certainly, if they got rid of Bottas to suddenly say, there you go. You know, Hamilton. I mean, I think, to be fair, Hamilton would probably take him on because he doesn't really care now. He's done, he's won six titles.
I wonder, because I think that if he'd say he got to seven and equaled Schumacher, I think then yes, he would.
Yeah.
Honestly, if he'd got, I know we keep saying, oh, the numbers don't matter. What a load of codswallop.
Yeah, of course, he's that close. Aye.
He might not be going, yes, I'm specifically going for this target, but he wants that target inside. Psychologically, you've got to be wanting to be, you've put all that work in for all those years. You want to be recognised for your work. And there's been some very interesting discussions about who's the fastest and this kind of stuff, and some people come up with some really stupid ideas. I one thing I do agree with is that Schumacher was not the fastest or the greatest racing driver we've had. Just isn't. He is the most successful at this point in that sense, but that was because he had the right. He had an incredible combination of abilities, which people don't recognise you need as a racing driver to be as successful as the likes of Schumacher was.
Yeah,
he did something Hamilton didn't do. He did something that Alonso didn't do, and he did something that very few other Formula One teams could do. He took a team that was struggling and he name another
right up there. I mean, in Ferrari, he joined in 1996 and by 97 it was competitive and he nearly won from Jacques Villeneuve.
It wasn't him getting a team together, but he recognized the team that he had and he made sure they kept them. And something that's being said, I think John Todd was talking about this, about the difference between Vettel and Schumacher, that Schumacher helped Ross Brawn and John Todd create an incredible unity in the Ferrari team. It ran like Mercedes does now.
Yeah.
Vettel doesn't do that. Vettel is what I would consider to be a user. I require this team to make me a car that's fast.
So
Schumacher, for all of his prickliness, what looked like prickliness on the outside, in that team, he was their dad and their brother, and that he was like,
he seemed to go on really well with them all.
We will bring this car on. There was none of this nonsense on the radios about screaming at people. If you look at the stuff that he did, you know, knocking people off the track and everything, it was never a petulant move. Like Vettel.
Yeah.
It wasn't a sort of a spitting your dummy out anger. It was cold calculated viciousness because he wanted to win. You know, it was very focused. He was an incredibly focused person. And in terms of Formula One driving, now, you and I are going to disagree on this. I know this because you're a huge Senna fan. Senna was a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And what an incredible talent. And as Brundle said, he could find grip in places you didn't know grip should exist. You know, it's like those races in the wet. and isn't that Lotus? That was a really uncompetitive car. Uncompetitive car. It was rubbish. He's in it. And he wins Monaco. He was amazing. And he was, again, very focused and all this kind of stuff. But Schumacher brought a new level of professionalism to the sport as a driver. So if you were going to get a driver that changed anything, I would say it was Schumacher because he changed how everyone did that job.
Yeah. Something everyone had to really put their game up. I mean, it made them look quite second rate.
Standing up and being like James Hunt with three women on your arms, smoking a joint and drunk. And go, I go in there, it's all amazing. You can't do that anymore. even old Nige, ferret face, with his boorish, bullish determination. Yeah. I mean, he had such a huge heart, and he put it all into his racing.
Yeah,
wasn't enough. What Schumacher did was he said, "Went right. What do you need to win? Apart from just pure talent, you need to be fit. You need to have physiotherapists. You need to have, you know, he got all this stuff lined up, ready to go." You need to make sure you're the number one driver and that no one's taking points away from you. He did all this kind of thing. Which is why, of course, Ferrari didn't want Ricciardo.
Yeah.
And when I was listening to that Five Live piece where Andrew Benson, the chief writer, was trying to explain to the other idiots, especially Palmer, and they just couldn't get it. That's what I don't understand. Basically said, look, he's got nothing to do. Why don't they have Ricciardo? He's a fast driver, he's an overtaker, all this kind of stuff. And he said, look, it's got nothing to do with how fast the driver is. They took Sainz because Ferrari needed a Sainz. They needed a fast, capable finisher who wouldn't the boat. What I've said to you about Bottas so many times, if you could get Bottas more consistent, the perfect wingman to their six times world champion. You start taking points away from six times world champion, he won't be seven times world champion.
Yeah.
Seven times world champion now if they hadn't taken Alonso on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Even with all the scrubs, he would, if Alonso's points, if he had, what was his name next year? His next teammate for his first world championship.
Raikkonen.
No, not like him. He wouldn't have cared. He would have
Was it not Kovalainen?
Kovalainen was fast, but not as fast as Lewis. And he was always second.
Yeah, that's...
Now, if that had been the year before, his rookie year, he'd have been a double world champion. He'd be the first rookie world champion. He would have been a double world champion much quicker, and he'd be seven times world champion now. Boom.
Yes, it's very interesting how it all.
Hamilton would have been 2014 world champion.
Yeah, no problem. And he nearly won in 2010 because he was ahead in 2010 and he lost 50 points between Monza and Singapore. He lost 25 points because he had accidents. And I remember because I was rooting for him and I watched the Monza race and he crashed into Massa at one of the first chicanes. Massa drove right into him at Monza. And I was so annoyed.
Massa turned across him.
Oh, yeah, right across him and put him off.
No, he didn't. Yeah. He overtook.
The McLarens looked really good.
He was there and Massa just went... Lewis Hamilton's dangerous. Take all his points away.
Yeah, and he lost 50 points. And in the end of that race, because he did finish another bit in relatively consistently the rest of the year, but he was on target to win both races, or certainly to score decent points, maybe win in Monza and do pretty well at Singapore. And I think he's going to be in the top three at least. And of course, because that, he only lost the championship by about 25 points or 27 points.
In Singapore.
Where?
Straight, and suddenly he's having to go straight on into the little offshoot road.
Oh, I'm not sure. He crashed into Mark Webber in 2010 at Singapore because I was watching it in the Czech Republic. I was on a kind of second honeymoon with my wife, and they were watching it on the Czech TV, and it was on, and of course that was the thing, and Webber and Hamilton clashed in that, but he was leading them. He would have won that title, and he would have wound it up probably by Japan. Well before Abu Dhabi, and he would have been, that would have been his third title. So potentially he could have 2007, 8, and 10.
But the point, I mean, that wouldn't have been affected by having a more compliant teammate, though.
No, that's true.
The point I was making is that a lot of people, they don't seem to understand that for a team to get a World Drivers' Championship, something Schumacher understood, frankly, something Alain Prost understood.
Yeah.
He had similar traits to Schumacher.
He didn't want Senna by next to him.
Exactly. He didn't want a competitor in the same team. And Frank, it took a while for Senna to understand that, because Senna was very open, wasn't he? He was very honest with his feelings. And he thought, well, if I'm straight, it was very like me in that respect. If I'm straight with other people, they'll be straight back with me. And that's simply not how most people in the world work, especially in that game. You know.
We wanted to compete with them in the same team to show who could do it.
Yes.
And then, you know, because it was, they were the power brokers of Formula One. That was like, you know, it was like Mansell and Piquet, Senna and Prost. All of that time, it was an incredible run of drivers.
Duel on the track. And what he didn't understand is there was a duel off the track, a political duel.
And
that was something Villeneuve understood. There's been, you know, there's some Piquet, that horrible little man, understood.
Yeah, no, it's quite interesting.
He turned the screws on Nige, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, for Lotus. Yeah, yeah. That, it's quite interesting. On a very funny note, I have to say, I've been playing a lot of Assetto Corsa recently on the PlayStation 4. And eventually the new one's coming out in the summer, the Assetto Corsa competition, which has got even more stuff and more tracks, and it should be great when it comes out. But I just got the original one, and I've got all the cars for it, and it's great fun. And the racing is hard. One of the blooming easy sessions.
You're finding that a fantastic game, aren't you?
Yeah, it's just the noise is better, and you've really got to try, because I put it on medium settings.
Okay.
And even then, it's like, and it's hard, because you can do like time trial, and you've got to do so many laps to get so many points. I can barely get halfway. You got to get like 15,000 points to qualify as a gold driver. I got like 7,500 at my very best. So it is hard going. You've got to, I maybe need an overtake button that I'm not able to use or something.
Dumpties like me.
To do so. It's quite hard.
I think if I got one, I wasn't even getting halfway towards qualification, I'd probably be giving up.
You know, but it's great fun. And I was racing at Brands Hatch, the Brands Hatch GP circuit, in these kind of, they call it a Tatius single seater. So I think it's like a Formula 3 car or something like that, that kind of style, or F4 kind of that style. And it's great fun, and you've got in the car, it's actually a normal gear stick, but obviously I use the semi-automatic on my steering wheel. But you can do such dodgy driving, and it is hilarious. I've never laughed as much during a race as I have done with this, because you can drive people off, because, you know, obviously we watch a lot of racing, so we know when people are coming out of a corner and they might not give that much room to a driver behind. But you can do all the tricks, and I didn't really do them on purpose. I just happened to, you know, I brake too late, or you can kind of almost push people behind, so because they're trying to keep you behind them.
We've been seeing some of the more dodgy moves on this virtual Grand Prix.
Yeah. So you would race right up behind them, and then knowing that it's a corner, but then you back off, brake a bit earlier, and of course they're not knowing where they were, so they out brake themselves, and then you can get the undercut usually and get through on the inside, which is quite good. But quite often, especially at Brands Hatch, going off the streets, and you come into the corner, I knew that we were basically neck and neck coming into the top kind of right hander, but I should have the poster here for the corner. And my car understeered quite a bit coming around. And of course, it's one of these ones you've really got to hold your speed. And the guy next to me was far quicker. He was much quicker, but I was beginning to get it right for the corner. And so my car just understeered, and I took him straight. Well, he just went straight off into the sand, and off he went, burled round.
Who did that move? In Brazil, where they went down the inside without bothering to brake, and just bounced off the inside.
That was Doornbos on Coulthard, was it not? Or Coulthard on Rosberg, maybe, but one of the two. It was turn four.
It's too far away, and he just went down.
And he just went straight in.
He did what I call the Ma manoeuvre. Because that's what I used to do on the only F1 game I've ever played many, many years ago. My car indestructible. And it was hard to do it, but his car was never indestructible. So he used to take
it. Well, mine didn't touch. To be fair, we didn't touch, but I just ran him out of the road completely. And then his car, you know, and the thing is, but they just see them go off into the sandpit. And then you come in down, it's not Druids, the first corner. But it's quite dodgy. It's kind of off camber, and it goes down the hill on the first corner of Brands Hatch. And again, I was wide because he used the whole track. And there was, you don't want to be on the outside. You always want to be on the inside there. And the guy on the outside, he just went straight off into the ground. And when I came around the next lap, I was actually expecting him to be there waving his fists at me, you know, to get out. As he's kind of beached on there. But it's really hard. It took me about 5 attempts, but eventually I won the race. But because there's certain corners where you're quicker than them and other corners where they're faster than you, you know. So, but it's really good because they try hard. And they block you, and they, you know, they had it on like 20% aggression for the other drivers, which is not really that high, but it's tougher than anything. And then I did Monza. I thought, I'll have a go at Monza without any practice on that. And I actually finished second, to be fair, on that one. But there were some quite ropey moves here, weaving and the braking, I think. But to be fair, they were very good to me, and I took far too many liberties. But it was... But the penalties were on, and I didn't get a penalty, to be fair.
Must have been the same people running that game as running the...
Yeah. I mean, I didn't cut the track. I always stayed on the track.
Well, that's but, that helps.
You know, that was the thing.
Just Demolition Derby. So Ant's on a bus, apparently, watching the show. So he's missed quite a bit of it. He's on the bus. And he wants to know that when you were doing this Settle Corsa, did you do your own commentary?
Well, the thing was, I laughed so much when I was coming over, when I saw when I overtook people and they went into the barriers.
Should have been me. Commentary on you.
Well, when I get the stuff, we'll be able to eventually do that. I need to get one of these Elgato stream machines thing, and then eventually I'll be able to start streaming properly
on Twitch or something like that. That's what they basically do, isn't it? They somehow don't they connect the game with Twitch, and you can hear what they're saying because there's anyone left on the track.
Yeah, pretty much. It was so funny though, because they are quite hard to do, but you can just learn the moves. And so coming into the last corner, into clearways, that was another really good one, because you just got really, you'd always go side by side with them, and then you would beg them on to brake far too late. So you just back off early and then cut in, and they always go late. And then they try and come across to scare you, but you, if as long as you get your nose in first, they won't bang you off the track, but it's quite close.
This is the aggression level, isn't it? If you pump that up, it'd be knocking you off the...
It's quite good. And I had a big shunt with somebody in Monza on the first attempt at the Ascari chicane, because it's, you know, the kind of left, right, left. And I was right up with them. And we went together around the left-hand bend and my wheels just touched and we both went cartwheeling round. But in that game, it's quite good because you can have spectacular accidents. You can really go up into the air. And go, you know, not quite over barriers and fences, but you can have some serious misdemeanors on it. But it's still the best game I ever played was Saloon Cars, which was an ancient one, I think, for BBC or for Acorn Models. It was Toka Touring Cars for the early PlayStation, because on that, if you crashed into somebody, they would get their own back. So the next time you raced them, they'd be after you. And they would. So if you began a kind of
programmed
season,
game,
yeah, it was brilliant.
And they got a vengeance on it.
Yeah, they would go after you. So it was fantastic. And there was one when it was like Formula Ford, and I was at Silverstone, and I'd had a tangle together, and literally it was a massive tangle. I'd sent somebody off, and they had kind of cartwheeled off the track, and you just saw them flying off away, and no penalty. You just carried on, and that was the thing. And when I came around the next time, I kid you not, they obviously must have had this programmed. The guy was next to his car in the gravel, and he was waving his fist at you. And it was absolutely brilliant. So I wish they would do that more in the car games now, you know, because I think it would be hilarious.
I mean, the F1 race I saw, the one at Hockenheim, the very last time the old circuit was used.
Yeah.
Which they've got. The Porsche Cup, and they've also got Formula 3 races and Formula 3000. Now, I remember the Formula 3 race. It was a weird, it was kind of like, I rationalised it like this, okay, that there's three types of driver in F3. Yeah. There's the really good ones.
Yeah.
And then they're like a third of the grid. Two-thirds of the grid is made up half who are rubbish and they know they're rubbish, and half who are rubbish but they think they're as good as the good ones. So what happens is that first half of the race is carnage. That's the ones that have got that little bit too much confidence.
Aye.
And compared
to consequences.
Taking out everyone as they go, I'm going for this move. And I remember at the Jim Clark curve on the screen, because this was the corner before where I was sitting, you see these cars cartwheeling like boing. You just saw every time they came to a corner, a car would go.
It was something, isn't it?
And then when they'd hit enough people that the rubbish but too confident ones had taken themselves out, and whichever poor sod they'd taken with them, it calmed down into a race instead of smash fest. It's just crazy.
We used to have a great title. It was the Rover 216 GTI Championship, and the three door. Yeah, great little car, Honda engine. If you can find one now, it'd be a bit of a barn find, to be fair. And they were. I remember what the intro was. It had this great music on it, and it was at Donington, and literally they would go around the first corner, and they had the guys who were in front, maybe the top three, and then they had this great mirror cam. So it looked from the back, it looked out the boot of the car to what was happening behind. And literally you'd see one guy get round from like fourth place right the way down to about 15th. He would miss his corner completely, spin off, and then end up, like, folk would smack straight into him. And there were cars going left and right in the air.
Image of cars going,
yeah. It was amazing. And they used to always use it on things like the Crash 'em and Smash 'em videos. Because, you know, in the 80s and 90s, they were quite big. You know, I'm sure it was Duke Video used to do, like, you know, motor racing's biggest crashes and all this kind of stuff. And you could buy it on a video of all these different series, and Murray Walker would sometimes commentate on them, and different people. But, I mean, they were hilarious to watch, because literally it was like a 15-car field, about six cars would finish, and more or less, you know. And it was the Rover parts department was incredibly busy on the Sunday and Monday after, you know, but it was worth watching.
Tiffany Dell is, used to, you know, the old Tiffany Dell, the tame racing driver.
Yeah.
You think, well, what's he won? What's he competed in and won? And it turned out he's competed in a few things, but the only thing he used to boast that he'd won was the Rover 220 Challenge.
Oh, yeah, they did that. It was a coupe, wasn't it? Rover 220.
The M16 engine it was called. See, once I kind of lost touch because they got boring.
Yeah, they had good engines in them.
They were very good.
They were
136, 250 horsepower. But then they turbocharged it, and you had the 202.
That's right, that they put in an over 600 and things like that, didn't they?
That was an 820 at 190 horsepower, because they had a tax, 195. It was 192 PS Pferdestärke, which is the German horsepower. It's a little bit less than British horsepower. And that was the change in tax. If you had an engine that was more powerful than that, and also in Germany, across Europe, really, you had to pay more as a business driver. So out came all these 2-litre turbocharged engines with just enough.
I just under it.
So they were quick, but not too quick. So
how many of them were chipped?
620 turbo. And one of my favourites, the 200 coupe. 220 turbo.
Yes, yeah.
Good little car. I mean, front wheel drive, limited slip diff, removable glass panels.
Well, you know, I saw one of the barn find programs, or it wasn't the official barn finds, but it was one when they go around Britain to look at old garages and stuff that's been abandoned.
Not shed and buried. What was the one I sent you thought I was joking?
I'm not sure, but this one was an abandoned Rover garage. And they had the garage. I think the showroom was finished, but in the kind of compound, they had all these Rover 400s and 200s up for sale. And they didn't have quite as much stuff. I don't think it was as really old. Maybe one or two old 200s, the kind of ones that you were talking about from the early 90s and stuff. But they had loads of kind of later 97 and 2000 cars, so stuff like that. But I thought if you could find some early 200s, they were a great car. I had a 216. GSI 5-door, by way back in, that would have been 98, 99, and I bought it for £500, and I got £450 when I sold it. and I had it for a year. And it was a great car. Brakes were terrible, but everything else was fantastic.
Well, those hot-derived ones, the ones that are loosely based on the, is it the Integra? Not the Integra. It might have been the Integra. I can remember the Concerto.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They were really, really good cars. My ex-wife's granddad, grandpa, he had about five in a row, all from new. Two 214 SIs. Okay, the beginning of the K series engine. The actual car itself, forgetting putting the engine to one side, because the K series had its own overheating issues, didn't it?
But, coolant problems were a real problem.
Clever engine, very clever design, all alloy with bolts going through it to give it stiffness, but screwed up the design like everything else. But they were very well made, and they were fully carbonized, so they didn't rust.
They were good cars. I love buying
drive as well. They were, like I say, they were based on a decent chassis, and they had the double wishbone suspension. What cars? The problem with the Honda Civic, and
that was a bestseller. That was the time when Rover hit the bestsellers mark with the Rover 200, and that was about the only car that did it for them.
Myself, a 420 or something like that, or 400. Yeah.
I nearly bought one for about 150 quid about 2 years ago. There was one up for sale. And I was so kind of, I would have quite liked it. I think it was a 420 SLI manual. And we were quite a quick car.
It would have been quick. Because they're light. It was before they screwed everything up by adding 10 tons of weight that you don't need, you know. And fake vent and fake sounds coming out of it. And get lost. I don't, honestly, if I get enough money together to get a car, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time looking for an older car that is in really good condition and make sure I keep it going, because I just don't like the new ones. They're just balls of fluff.
There was a immaculate Fiat Tipo from 1993, I think it was, or 94, for £650 on Auto Trader not that long ago.
They had a 2 litre turbo of that was quick.
This was only a 1.4 petrol 5-door, but it was immaculate. An old person had it, and it was really clean and that. So, I thought that would have been quite fun.
20-valve, 5-cylinder.
The Sedisa Valvolet thing, wasn't it?
My ex-wife gave me a compliment. I can still remember. M&K Garages in Colwyn Bay, which is no more. It's now a Lidl's. It's now an Aldi's.
That's become so many Fiat garages.
It was a Fiat Rover garage. A Rover.
And where no car starts.
We lost a baby, but we both loved Alphas. We were a bit down, and we just drove to Golden Bay and looked around Alfa Romeos. And this guy was like, we said, oh, can I help you? And I said, no, we're just looking around. And you could see we were a bit down, and we just told him, and he just said, oh, sit in any car you like. Then he let us spend like 3 hours just sitting in all the cars, just cheering ourselves up a little tiny bit. This beautiful blue Fiat Coupe. That car really suits you. And I think that's the only time in 28 years she ever gave me an actual compliment. The thing is, it did. And it had a good chassis as well, and that engine.
You can still get them. But they've gone up in value. They're maybe £2,000-£3,000 for a rough one, and maybe five or six or more, even up to 10 or 12 for a decent one.
Unique cars. They just don't... Name a car that's unique like that now for less than £50,000.
It was cheap. It was cheap for them. It's like, they're not about 13.5-14 grand at the time.
220 horsepower, and with the sound of a 5-cylinder. Yeah.
They were a bit more.
Emissions regulations.
Yeah. They were about 17 or 18, but that was a great car for the time. Fantastic car for the money. I love that. That was a special time, and you kind of knew it was a special time, and I just wish I'd been in the motor trade more at that point. Because it would have been so much fun.
Handled very well, did they? And the tyres weren't very good.
Yeah, brakes were poor and
fat and fluffy. And it's kind of like there was that crossover between. It was almost the perfection. We've got it at that point. So I'd love to go to get something older, and upgrade with the latest dampers and the latest technology in terms of dampers and handling and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Tune the engine with the latest bits. And see what happens, because I'll tell you what, it would be light and it would be fun and it would sound great. I think Chris Harris did a video with an old Giulietta. And
yes, that was really good.
And this thing was quick because it weighed as much as that.
You could pick it up.
Of course, because it's this old engine that's been beautifully tuned and beautifully modified.
But you know, he bought one that was rebuilt. It was like a, a replica, wasn't it? It was like, but it was so real to the
original car. It's original, but it had been modernized. You know, like you get the Eagle E Type.
All right, so better brakes and
But it's literally the stuff they can do in engines now compared with 30 years ago. The power and the responsiveness responsiveness getting out of these cars, but in an old proper car. Harry Metcalf, he's the same. He's got these older cars. He's really affected me in what with his garage. He's got these older Lancias and Alphas and all this kind of stuff, all sort of breathed upon.
Yeah.
He's got a Jag XJ12 coupe. You know, the pillarless ones?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it's been tuned. He got it, and it's a manual. And you don't find many.
There are not many of them.
It's called. And he's got this car, and he's done two videos on it. He's got it without him changing anything, and you could tell it's all a bit, dampers are short and all this kind of stuff. He said, but it sounded amazing and was quite quick. And then had it sorted and had the suspension sorted and the engine redone. Bloody hell. It goes like a rocket. He says it's one of his favourite cars to drive because all the stuff you used to be able to feel, you can't anymore because you're insulated from it.
Yeah.
With his throaty V12 Jag engine in the front. Fuel injected.
It's funny because, you know, there was like, remember I showed you that video of there were all the cars in the woods and there was that amazing Mercedes SL and so many Range Rover three doors, incredible stuff. And they were all quite whole. That was the amazing thing. A lot of them were actually in quite reasonable looking condition and a lot of them had their own engines and they obviously just been left there abandoned and nothing had happened to them. They had been sold for bits. Yeah. They were clearing the whole place out. And in America, you know, I think the Americans are a little bit more kind of ready to have a go at something because, you know, there's all these kind of programs like Turning Rust and Haggerty and where they'll actually go in. And there's one that they go into a scrapyard and they try and drive a car out of there that hasn't moved for 20 years. This is the challenge. So they try and find something. And they've all got like rats or mice or all sorts of things in the cars. They're cleaning out the mice poop.
Throwing through them and stuff like that. How the hell do you get that?
If it's got a tree in it, it might struggle. But anything that's been sitting that doesn't have a tree in it, they try and they, you know, it might be an old Corvette or an old muscle car or something. You know, it's amazing what they do, and they can tell if the car's seized or not because, you know, they can do the fan and all this stuff, and they go right in there and they have the stuff with them as well to kind of grease it up and oil it up, and then they can take the fuel pumps off and put their own fuel in and stuff, so they can kind of, they know how to shortcut some of the systems. And I wish they had those guys in that forest, because I would have thought they would have taken every Range Rover that was there, because they're just all V8 engines and the rest of it, and we'd have got them going. I reckon they would have been all right. And, you know, I mean, imagine having a three-door Range Rover. You know, that's one of my, you know, I'd love one of those, because and also the original three-door Discovery, I used to love them. We very nearly bought one.
An old early 80s three-door V8 Range Rover. It's the one who was Tomcat. The Bowler Tomcat, which is before the Wildcat.
Ant's saying he'd like to have a Sunbeam coupe.
Now, I saw that. I was waiting. Do you mean the Lotus coupe, the Lotus Sunbeam, or do you mean? What do you mean?
Auntie had a Talbot Sunbeam.
I'm being stupid. I know exactly what he means. I know exactly what he means because his dad had one.
That's it.
You know, there's a certain type of 70s car which looks really 70s, but actually it's cool.
Was it the Mark III? What was the Cortina that looked incredibly cool? Was it the
one and two?
Yeah, they were one and two. Because the one that were not the one that was like mid-80s, but the one before that, I think it must have been a one or a two, wasn't it? And they looked really cool.
Were a completely different shape. They were more American in the shape than the Mark III.
Yeah, quite square and quite
square. And it was okay with the twin headlamps and all that kind of stuff. And then in the Mark IV, Yeah. Looked like someone had just dropped a box.
Yeah, that's what we had. I think we had in, we had a W Edge and a, I think it was an eight, was it a, yeah, a W Edge and possibly a T Edge one. Both incredibly unreliable. But when we sold the, when we traded the last one in for a Cortina, for a Montego, and literally they had to take it away on a truck, it just seized up. And then the dealer came along with his rescue truck.
Montego, because every Montego I've had has been the worst cars I've ever owned, apart from that 1.6 diesel Vauxhall, C-Range Vauxhall Cavalier Mark II, which was pants.
That's
it. Better, and that blew up once, and the gearbox exploded on it another time, and that was still better than that Cavalier.
That's quite funny, isn't it? Well, on that note, we've been going for over an hour and 10 minutes, so our audience has put up with an awful lot, but they're a good audience to have. And remember to see all our other videos. If you click on the Car Sim and Race Driver Show and look for Hugh Hattrick on YouTube, you'll get to see all of our other videos, and also on our website you can subscribe to the channel there as well, and look out for our podcast.
Tell us what older car they would like and they remember.
Yes, because we could go on for days and days. What are the cars that you would like as a barn find? Imagine you've bought a house and they say, well, by the way, did you not know in the deeds there's a garage around the corner, and we think there's a whole bunch of stuff in it, but we've just lost interest. So they are the keys, off you go. What would you like to find in the back of that? Could you imagine if you could just dust off the windows and you just see the front of a Jaguar badge on the thing, and you open it up and it's an XK120 or something like that in there, or a coupe, an XK120 coupe would be quite something, or an old Alfa Romeo Giulietta in perfect nick under a nice cover, a canvas cover that's still original paintwork. Oh, you know, you find all the paperwork inside and it's all fine. What would you like?
You see, I was thinking, but then you kept saying cars and I'm going, ooh.
I'm thinking GTO?
How nice it would be. I don't know, because I don't fit in them very well. I have actually sat in one. About my favourite Alfa is mad as a brush, and they only made 1,000 of them, which is the Alfa Romeo SZ. Based on the 75, it's got the 3-litre Busa engine in it, which is the finest V6 engine ever to be made. It's a work of art, internally and externally. It looks amazing. Yeah. It's like having the world's most... It's like having Kate Beckinsale. Let's leave it at that.
That would be it, wouldn't it? I just imagine opening those doors, and there's a few incredible classics sitting in there under canvas.
I'll tell you what I would like, because I was watching a video on him earlier. You know, I've talked about Alan Milliard, who I can recommend, who's a nutter. It's an absolute crazy man. He makes the most amazing things in his garden. He's made a 6-cylinder, now the Kawasaki motorbike, but they had them, they existed. But it was a 1300 Z1300 was a 6-cylinder Kawasaki motorbike. He didn't make one of those. He took that and turned that into a V12. Nothing normal. The 6-cylinder one he made was from the 900cc 4-cylinder, and he added 2 cylinders. So you've got like a 1200cc. Anyway. He's made this thing, and he took it out for his first test ride, and I don't think I've heard an engine that sounds so nice, because it's a 70s bike.
Yeah. Not
any of this nonsense about catalytic converters and things in the way. It just
So that would be your pick. Actually, a Capri. Bike. I would like a Capri RS2000. RS2000 Escort, maybe the rally one, or the Mexico, the Escort Mexico, that one would be quite.
That 4-cylinder engine. I'm not a great fan of 4-cylinder engine sounds. Most of them sound a bit flat.
That's good.
You know, inline 4. There's something about that. Bob, watch videos of Adi Vartanen charging around in one of those RS2000s or a Mexico, and he's just this kind of like yeah, you know what's coming.
There was an amazing video of one of the former, I think it was a Peugeot employee, and they had this, they obviously have, I think they must have a museum somewhere at the factory or near the somewhere in France, where they have all the Peugeots and Citroëns and so on. And he was asked to go in and check on the cars that were in this factory or one of the buildings. And I don't think it had been used very much because it was, I think maybe they'd closed the museum or whatever it was for restoration or something. And I think it had gone to the way, but you know, to be put on the side while they were doing other things. So the guy goes in with his video, or I think just with his phone, not real, he wasn't expecting to film anything. And then he goes up there and he suddenly realizes what is in this factory or this old barn. And it's like the rally cars, the Peugeot 205 rally cars from, and all the, you know, before the 205 and all of those special ones from the 80s. It had like the Pope's car that they had built out of an old, like a 506. It had, it's on YouTube. And they had left it in this bit. I mean, nobody's about. And they had all these different cars in the bit. I'll have to have another look on YouTube about it. You can just look at like Peugeot Classics factory or something of it. It'll come up. As if, you know, the factory classics, barn finds, kind of like old cars, and everything of that, all that incredible era. They had sports cars, they had ancient stuff, like from the early like 1900s, or you know, for the first Peugeot cars, right the way through the decades. And so he just looks at this stuff, and it's all in great condition, you know, it's all because it's all been it's maybe a bit dusty, but that's about it. And he goes round them and has a look at most of them. And it's honestly, it's eye watering. It put, you know, makes you quite emotional when you see it.
I mean, the 205 T16 was just a monster.
But yeah, 405 rally car, or 405 touring car.
Andy Vartanen took the 405 up Pike's Peak, didn't he?
And
he
it had that one. I'm sure it had that in it.
Four wheel drive, four wheel steering, some ridiculous power.
Yeah, nothing. It had all that stuff in there. Had bread vans, just, like all these Peugeot bread vans and different things that they had tested and come up with, you know. And it's because, like, when I went to the Rover Museum when it was at Gaydon before they closed, before they got taken over and they went bust, they had a Montego with a Rover 200 interior. And it had all, because it had some of the cars that were supposed to replace the Montego, or, you know, that they had designs like what are they, like concept cars. Hmm. So what they were planning on doing with the Montego, and it looked like a Montego.
Ideas. They never did anything weird. There was a car, I can't remember the name of, which probably would have been at that museum because it was a one-off, which was designed as an incredibly low-drag motor.
Yeah.
Montego Maestro.
Aye.
Really, like a 0.28.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think I can seem to remember that.
And then, of course, being British, they went, oh, no, 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 that.
I remember that because I went for the tour. It was a great museum. And outside they had Land Rover Defenders. And there was a kind of off-road track that they took you on and round about to show how good the Defender was. And we were waiting because there was the Land Rover in front had a problem, or they were waiting for a passenger to get on and they couldn't get on and so on. So the driver, something happened to the driver. So the driver in our Land Rover, I was sitting up front with Jonathan alongside me. I think we were just behind the front. I remember we were in the first two seats. It was one of these ones where they have two seats in the front. I can't quite remember. Maybe it didn't. But either I was in the front seat or I was in the one behind.
Recently, when you said today.
No, this was a lot. This was 20 years ago or more, maybe even 25 years ago.
Suddenly I thought you gated on, and that's where you went the other day.
No, that was Brooklands. Brooklands. We went to Brooklands.
And I wonder whether they made a museum of Rover cars there as well. I just wondered. Yeah, sorry, carry on.
Aye, so it was all there. And the guy said to me, because we've been talking away on the build-up to the whole run, we couldn't wait to get out onto this course. And so he obviously trusted me. And he said, you know what, mate? I've got to go and drive this other Land Rover because the driver's not going to come for a few minutes. So I want you just to drive this Defender and follow me. And the thing is, there were another three people in this car. It was one of it was a Defender that they had made extra seats in the back and did all stuff. Precisely for taking people on these trips. The guy just asked me to do it. I wasn't insured. I wasn't, I was only like, I would have been 20.
Can you imagine doing that now?
Yeah, I was maybe under 20. I would have been 20, 21 at very most. And he says, can you drive? Have you got a license? And I went, yep. So I just wandered around and he said, just follow me. We're only going to drive, you know, a few hundred yards. And all the rest of them, and the passengers looked shocked. as I jumped in and I went, okay, then put my seatbelt on and put it in. I had done a bit of off-road driving in Land Rovers, to be fair. So I knew a bit about the car at that time. And so off I went, and I was the one who was doing the driving for a few hundred yards. And he said, "Yeah, so that's fine." But we had to go over some fairly rough bits, and you know, it was great fun. So I was really chuffed at being able to do that. You know, that.
Tell you what, I'd like to do. I would genuinely. There's two projects I'd like to do. Because I was thinking about the barn find out question you gave me before.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Mark 1 MR2.
Yes. Yeah.
Now the Mark 1 MR2 is actually a Lotus. That's why it's so much better than the Mark 2 and the Mark 3, because they were crap.
Oh.
Mark 1 MR2 was the X100, and it was a Lotus project. And what was happening at the time is that Lotus were using Toyota bits and part payment for some, because they had their money, they gave them the design. Which is why, if you think about, if you look at that car, it's got everything that the Elise has.
Yeah.
Light, small engine, excellent chassis, brilliant.
The MR2 did really well.
Owned one, so I've driven it, and it is really nice to drive. But the engine is powerful. It's 122 horsepower for 1.6.
But imagine with a Toyota gearbox would be really good.
Everything about it. Because I mean, no power steering.
Yeah.
So a bit heavy at low speeds, but you know, our age, we're used to that. Like you're talking about, oh, it's really heavy steering. No, it's just called steering, you divs. Power steering, not heavy steering. Whatever. So everything's there. And then you've got a big, it's not a transmission tunnel because the transmission's in the back, but you've got a big lump in the middle and you rest your arm on it and there's your gear stick. It's not down, it's there. It's set up just for driving. But they made 1,000 supercharged versions.
Wow.
1,000 of them in Britain with 140 horsepower. But the difference is it's the torque. The naturally aspirated, injected 1600 revved beautifully. I mean, it was nice and smooth. That I didn't mind revving that one. You were at 6,700 RPM and you're like, oh, okay. And obviously, completely... I was nowhere where breaking the law, officer, but 200 miles an hour. But if you were on a hill and you changed up to fourth, it slowed down because you had no torque. You basically overtook everybody in third. But the supercharged version wouldn't have had that problem. The five-speed box. Now, the original one, but the mad idea I always had was sticking a VR6 engine in the back of it. Because it would fit. You would have a six-cylinder monster. But more recently, I've changed my mind. I would, you know, they call it the V5 on the back of the Golf, but it's the VR5.
Yeah. They were nice sounding engines. Yeah, they were nice.
It's a multi-cylinder engine, isn't it? The idea of the VR engine, which people don't understand, it stands for foul iron mortar, V straight six. So it's a 50-degree narrow-angle six-cylinder motor.
Mm.
Or five-cylinder, four-cylinder, whatever you like.
Yeah.
And then because they're so compact, they would get multiples of them. So the W8 engine that you're getting a pass at is two VR4 engines put on a cone crank in a V. So it's kind of like a W. The problem you got is the valves on the top, because how do you get the valves to push things down? Well, this is where part two of my mad plan comes in. Koenigsegg have invented a camless valve actuation thingy. Did I tell you about the video? They've got a video on it. You can Koenigsegg show all this stuff because they're nuts. Christian von Koenigsegg is mad. I love them. They modify, if you've got the money, they will modify your engine. And basically, they machine off the top of your cylinder head with all the nonsense and they just change it for this special. It's all pneumatically actuated, it's almost like an F1 engine. All the things you can do with it, you just can't imagine. This is why they've got a 600 horsepower, 2 litre, 3 cylinder engine in the back of the latest car.
Because
it's just craziness. And it's only got 3 cylinders. One of the things is it's got this mad valve thing. So all the problems you got with this VR5 engine, suddenly it's not as tall, it's littler, and it's a five cylinder, so it sounds like, you know, like an Audi Quattro. Yeah. And it fits, and you can have a 6-speed box, and you're in the back of one of the best chassis that's ever been made.
Yeah. I have to say, an Audi Quattro. I have that. That's certainly what I'm saying. But if you can find an earlier Audi Quattro as well, that would be a nice three-door.
You got the money to buy. You know how much they cost now? Lots of money.
Yeah, I'd, of course.
I'd actually have the S2, which when they went to the bubbly shape, so it's aerodynamic instead of a brick, they put, as a sort of a thing, they put the 20-valve engine in.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Four-wheel drive.
That would be something.
So it's not as true.
Well, they had one of those in the woods. They had one of those. They had a. Well, actually, it was an Audi GT coupe, I think, possibly. Or was it? Was it a Quattro?
So nice. I had a Passat for a while. The old Mark II Passats. The old 80s Passats. Basically, it's an Audi 80.
Yeah.
With a Volkswagen badge on it and a hatchback. So you've got a practical car that sounds like an Audi Quattro, but with a 2-liter engine. But in Germany,
it's very so distinct.
So again, another mad idea: put an Audi Quattro engine in the front of a Volkswagen Passat and surprise people.
Yeah, which is always good fun. Always good fun. Well, on that note, it's been an hour and a half of banter and racing chat with me, Hugh Hattrick, and of course my co-host, as always, Andrew Marr. Now, we're going to have a very special guest as well in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, yes.
A chap who actually has connections to the world of Formula One, but I can say no more than that. I'm going to try and get the cat.
By a Formula One car.
Sorry?
Is it that he once got run over by a Formula One car?
Well, that he actually works for a Formula One team.
Real connections, not just like.
Yes, real connections. Now, if anyone has stayed to watch to the very end of this video, I admire your courage. But there you were. So, in 2 weeks' time, June the 4th at 9 o'clock, we'll have a very special guest. I will confirm the name next week. But he is actually is heavily involved in an official Formula One team. So, it will be good to get him on board to come on the live show. So, there'll be the three of us on that night.
Ask the intelligent questions. He's good at that.
But to everyone, thank you very much for watching. And if you're listening here on the podcast, that will be coming out probably on Friday, which will be the 22nd of May. It's fantastic to have you with us. Have a great, great week. And we'll be back on Sunday night with some live commentary, probably, potentially from Monaco. We'll see what happens. It's time to drive fast and try not to crash. Bye from me.
And goodbye from me. And him. Two runners, yes.